Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
And I would like to actually start by focusing on two quotations, one from Tolkien himself, and another from one of the best and deepest readers of Tolkien, the late Stratford Caldecott, who I had the gift to know and from whom I learned so much about not only Tolkien's vision, but also his enduring contributions for our time. And there, if you'd like, in the question period, I'm also very happy to recommend books. And the first person I would suggest as a resource for you would be Stratford Caldecott on his work on Tolkien, as well as Beppe Pizzini, who is has just published a book on Tolkien's aesthetics with Cambridge University Press. So here are the two quotes I would like to start with. First, this is a quotation from Tolkien in his later life, within the last few years of his life. And it's a brief but telling admission. And it's from a letter to his publisher. He was talking to his publisher about the fact that for a time, due to an injury, he wasn't able to use his right arm. And he found this deeply painful because it meant he couldn't write. And for him, writing was life and life was writing. He says, "I found not being able to use a pen or pencil as defeating as the loss of her beak would be to a hen." Okay, and then there's another quotation I would like to share with you, and then I'll talk about why I'm starting off this way. So this is an introduction to Tolkien as a thinker, and this is from Stratford Caldecott's book, The Power of the Ring. And this is what he says. "Tolkien was an explorer. The stories in which he invested so much time and energy are notes of his expeditions in search of an older or inner world. Over the years, he added revision after revision, layer after layer, working late into the night, filling in a vast historical canvas, weaving theme upon theme, until the whole collection resembled a great tree of tales, like the gnarled oaks he loved." Both quotations emphasize Tolkien's remarkable dedication to the craft of writing, his growing self-understanding as a writer who, without his pen or pencil, felt somewhat defeated, and his understanding of writing as an exploration of the interior landscape, or, as Caldecott puts it, the inner world of life, of the human condition. It also suggests, I hope, how much Tolkien loved what he did as a writer and artist. It also, I should think, makes you wonder why I would title my talk Tolkien's Detached Aesthetics, when it seems he was remarkably attached to his work, to his writing, to the aesthetic vision which unfolded as he traveled further and further in search of an older or inner world. The apparent contradiction between Tolkien's commitments and my description of his aesthetics as detached is only apparent. My hope is to show, throughout this talk, how the Christian tradition understands the process of cultivating a spiritual detachment as the process of growing more and more in love with the goodness of being, with the goodness of the created world, and most importantly, in love with God, the origin of all that is. However, to convince you that Tolkien's aesthetics is ultimately a detached kind, I will need to first explain what exactly I mean by detachment and what I don't, before we then turn to Tolkien's own modeling of detachment in his writings. The history of detachment in the long Christian tradition is a very rich one, stretching as far back as the Hebrew prophets to our own times, and brought to a remarkable pitch in the lives of saints as recent as John Paul II, Edith Stein, or Mother Teresa. But more recently, detachment has been profoundly misunderstood or mischaracterized, especially in the context of late modernity. For instance, for many of the emerging late modern writers, such as James Joyce, for whom religion had become a problem as opposed to an answer, detachment was one of the many aspects of the Christian tradition that he was uncomfortable with, that he even sought to critique. He cast detachment as that which creates cold indifference, a religious fervor that neglects love of neighbor in favor of intensive scrupulosity. He also claimed that detachment is a manifestation of God's calculated distance from the world, that it is a divine attribute. In A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, for example, he presents an image of God as a detached observer, a bit like the deist God of the Enlightenment. This detached God pares his nails, Joyce says, as he watches humanity suffer. Given the horrors and traumas of the 20th century, which Pope John Paul II in his visit to Auschwitz-Birkenau called our difficult century, many artists, philosophers, and cultural critics decided, somewhat like James Joyce, that if there is a God, he must be an uncaring and coldly detached one. This is, in short, one part of detachment's reception history, perhaps its revision, in the context of late modernity. However, in especially drawing from the example of Tolkien's life, aesthetic theory, and writing, as well as his inheritance that comes expressly from the long Christian tradition, I want to focus on a very different understanding of detachment, and one only made available, I argue, within Christianity, and which, for Tolkien, became an important resource for him, not only for his writing, but in his own life. And I hope, as you can see from the first quote, that really his life and his writing were, you know, you can't really parse the two. Detachment in the long Christian tradition is not indifference. It is the exact opposite of indifference. It is a watchful, charitable care for God, the self, others, and creation. But it is a care that does not turn any goods into God. Detachment is closely linked, especially in the writings of Saints Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, and Thérèse of Lisieux, for example, is very linked to a humble self-giving in the service of God and out of love of neighbor. It is an exodus from the ego. It is looking outward rather than being too focused on the self. Detachment is the process of allowing ourselves to be the grain of wheat, which, as Christ notes repeatedly in Scripture, in order to be planted and bear fruit, must fall to the ground, must, in a sense, seem to be sacrificed. For Thérèse of Lisieux, a near contemporary of Tolkien, and about whom he was interested, for Thérèse of Lisieux, detachment was a radical act of love for God, a profession of faith which says that he alone can satisfy us and that all other things and persons are to be treated with a reverence and a respect, but not to be possessed or even worshipped. Tolkien's dear friend, C.S. Lewis, who is also deeply interested in the Christian call and history of detachment, draws in his book, The Abolition of Man, from St. Augustine to define detachment as the ordering of our affections. I thought I had a quote, but I don't, so we'll just return to this lovely image of a tree for a moment. And this is what Lewis says. St. Augustine defines virtue as ordo amoris, the ordinate condition of the affections, in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it. The opposite of detachment is more than attachment. It is selfish possessiveness. It means, as Tolkien once put it, to link our inner powers or talents with the corrupted force of dominating, bulldozing the real world or coercing other wills to make people conform to our own plans or ideas or initiatives, irrespective if they are good for other people. Tolkien's understanding of spiritual growth, including detachment, was shaped by his great devotion to the saints, like Thomas Aquinas, but he was also especially influenced by John Henry Newman, who, while not a beatus, let alone a canonized saint in Tolkien's lifetime, already stood out as a saint, according to Tolkien. Newman, the founder of the first English oratory of St. Philip Neri, inspired not only Tolkien's spiritual life and writings, but also his personal particular history. As many of you might know, Tolkien lost his father when he was 4 years old, and when he lost his mother at 12, his guardian was an oratorian priest, Father Francis Morgan, who had known Newman. Newman only died a few years before Tolkien was born. And Father Francis Morgan, as guardian, cared for Tolkien and his brother with the kind of pastoral spirit of affection, humor, and wisdom so characteristic of Newman himself, though Father Francis Morgan was a bit more intense in some ways. Newman has a great deal to say about detachment, most of which he proposes we can best understand by meditating upon the life of Mary, God's mother, who was the only human being to possess and maintain a rightly ordered spirit of detachment toward creatures. And thus she is a fitting intercessor, Newman says, before God, on behalf of humanity, because she was never blinded by private, selfish preferences or priorities. She radically opens her arms to the entire world. Tolkien, like Newman, had a deep devotion to Mary, and in many of his letters, he proposes that her obedience and person inspired the very spirit of his work and writing, usually implicitly and in ways which surprised even him. For those of you familiar with Tolkien's letters, they're a very rich resource for further thought on his part about the very nature of his work. And you see him revising and turning and returning to aspects of his interpretation of his work over the years. And this very much feeds into his understanding that so much of inspiration is something that cannot be rationally explained. It comes as sort of through you, as opposed to you being the sole agent or the person controlling it. So there has to be a detached kind of receptivity on the part of the artist to pay attention, to look at the world, to do the hard work of writing down what one is receiving as one is receiving it. So back to my main point that Tolkien had a deep devotion to Mary, just like Newman. And many Tolkien fans in the room have possibly noted that the date of the destruction of the One Ring in Tolkien's mythology aligns with the Feast of the Annunciation, which is the feast that marks Mary's assent to the angel Gabriel's proposal or request that she become the mother of God. Mary's yes for Tolkien reverberates across all of history, and not just in history, but also in legend. Her yes extends the alphabet of the writer, the poet. However, bearing all this in mind, Tolkien's insights into detachment are most fully shaped by Christ's frequent invitation in the scriptures to watch and pray and not to become consumed by the cares of this world. Newman, too, draws precisely from Christ's call to all to watch and pray, as found, for instance, in Mark chapter 13, verse 33. In his sermon on this very biblical passage, Newman defines detachment in the following way. Now, do bear with me. This is a long quotation here, but I think it's worth going through the different parts that Newman identifies as part of the mode of detachment, the process of detachment, because it will be important for the talk as we move forward. Our Savior, says Newman, this is a homily, so he's writing in a confessional mode, okay? For those of you not very familiar with Newman, he is a master of various different genres and prose styles. I highly recommend Idea of University to all of you here who are in university. But here he's speaking in a very confessional and meditative as well as teaching mode because he is preaching. Our Savior, he says, gave this warning when he was leaving this world, so when he was ascending to the Father. Leaving it, that is, as far as his visible presence is concerned. He looked forward to the many hundred years which were to pass before he came again, in his promise to come again. He knew his own purpose and his Father's purpose, gradually to leave the world to itself, gradually to withdraw from it the tokens of his gracious presence, his physical person, as the apostles knew him. He contemplated, as contemplating all things, the neglect of him which would spread even among his professed followers, the daring disobedience and the loud words which would be ventured against him and his Father by many whom he had regenerated, and the coldness, cowardice, and tolerance of error which would be displayed by others who did not go so far as to speak or to act against him. He foresaw the state of the world and the church as we see it this day, when his prolonged absence has made it practically thought that he will never come back in visible presence. And in the text, he mercifully whispers into our ears not to trust in what we see, not to share in that general unbelief, not to be carried away by the world, but to take heed, watch, pray, and look out for his coming. Detachment, Newman then goes on to conclude, is a mode of watching, of attending and discerning how the present moment should be lived in imitation of Christ's example and in light of his promise to return. This then is to watch, says Newman, to be detached from what is present and to live in what is unseen, to live in the thought of Christ as he came once and as he will come again, to desire his second coming from our affectionate and grateful remembrance of his first coming. Detachment, as we can see then, is not cold indifference. Rather, it is about a careful way of being in the world, of attending. It is a careful attention to God, the self, and others, which looks to Christ as the example. as the guide for our evaluation of the present moment in light of Christ's promised return. In other words, detachment means not to be carried away by the world, but to charitably bring the needs, cares, and desires of the world before God in prayer and contemplation. Although deep in Newman and scripture and the lives of the saints, Tolkien also had to find his own way to live out this spiritual detachment. It's clear that his writing is one of the ways in which his spiritual life deepened. It was a kind of unconscious prayer at times, and he says things along these lines in his letters. Other times it was very conscious, but he has some very interesting comments throughout his more personal writings about how sometimes images almost came unbidden to him that he just wrote down, and other times he had to labor very hard, revise and revise over and over again in order to try to do justice to certain passages of his story. Tolkien, like the war poets, the atheistic existentialists, the protesting modern novelists, like James Joyce, for example, had great cause from a strictly human or historical perspective to be resentful, to get carried away by the world and its problems, to think that if there was a God, he must be an indifferent one. By the time he was 12, Tolkien was an impoverished of sorts orphan. His mother, upon her conversion to Roman Catholicism, shortly before she had died, was disinherited by her family. That was a standard practice of the time for cultural and also some legal reasons. By his mid-20s, Tolkien had experienced the atrocities of World War I, barely surviving the Battle of the Somme, one of the war's bloodiest battles. When he caught trench fever, a disease contracted by lice in the trenches, Tolkien was sent back to England to recover. But the effects of this disease and the trauma he experienced at the front would remain with him for the rest of his life. In later life, Tolkien, who was too old to serve in the Second World War, had to also anxiously await every day to learn whether one of his sons, who was a soldier and fighting in the war, whether he would survive. He also had to witness the threats of the Cold War, and among other things, certain changes to liturgical worship within the Roman Catholic faith, which for him and many of his contemporaries was a very difficult trial. All of a sudden, the place that he felt most at home, he went to daily mass, felt somewhat alien because certain aspects of liturgical practice had changed. However, with all of these things, and it led many of his contemporaries to rebel, to resist, to stop practicing their faith, or to cease to even create art, Tolkien instead drew from these experiences by trying to discern in them what they might be telling us, but also in his writing, he wanted to show that there is more than just, we are more than the sum of our miseries or our difficult experiences. In noting some of the things about his life that are difficult, I'm only tracing the well-known and more existentially fraught episodes of Tolkien's life that are public. For any who do read his letters, you can see that he shared many of the ordinary annoyances and struggles, and also some rather deep private sorrows which he didn't want to share as well. But I want to highlight the exceptional load of suffering in which he shared, in part because of the time in which he was born, to, among other things, gain a greater respect for the virtues his way of storytelling exhibit. Because it is always a greater effort, a tougher path, to write a story that is not overcome by the darkness. It's hard to forge a path when the way seems pathless, especially if you're just relying on what is immediately at hand or visible to you. But I also want to remind us of his suffering to emphasize that he had just as much cause to protest, to grow resentful, or to reject belief as many of his contemporaries, who did write remarkable but unsettling lamentations in which the possibility of a good God was rejected. By contrast, the belief in a good God, which is what kept Tolkien grounded, and we're going to see ways in which this belief implicitly shapes or saturates a lot of his work and helps him to keep kind of, let's say, hierarchy of priorities, as it were, which you need if you're to follow the road of spiritual detachment. Rather than becoming embittered by his sorrow, Tolkien's writings show the working of a mind that isn't resentful, that is fundamentally grateful. And Tolkien could be grateful precisely because he could also feel all the depths of his loss and suffering. However, across his life, we see him increasingly cultivate a watchful, that is a Christian detached, approach in his writing. In the next part of my talk, I want to close read a few passages from Lord of the Rings and some of his other writings to illustrate in greater detail what I mean by detached aesthetics and detachment in Tolkien more broadly. So a detached narrative style offers the opportunity of reframing narratives according to the logic of a wider, deeper wisdom. This is certainly the case in Tolkien, a wisdom which refuses to subordinate all concerns to the sorrows and difficulties experienced in the present moment or which haunt us from the past. There are multiple examples of how Tolkien reframes the narrative throughout The Lord of the Rings, wresting it from the evil forces of Sauron's totalitarian malice and violence. I'd like to focus on a short example which, while brief, actually made me pause for quite some time when I reread The Return of the King last semester. And in fact, it's just a small passage which the many other times I've read The Lord of the Rings, I don't even remember paying attention to. So it's not a standard passage, and I thought that might also make it more interesting for us tonight. During the Battle of Pelennor Fields, the orcs, under the command of Sauron, catapult the hewn, maimed and branded heads of their enemies, the men of Gondor, over the high walls of Minas Tirith to strike terror and despair into the hearts of all who see them. As you will see in the following passage, Tolkien does not skirt around the atrocity of the act, but he does not allow the intended terrorization to have the last word. I know it's a bit of a long passage, but I do want to read it out loud, and then I'm going to analyze some aspects of it for you. To illustrate some of the points I'd like to communicate. So here the narrator is talking about this terrorized assault. It was no brigand or orc chieftain that ordered the assault upon Minas Tirith, the lord of Mordor's greatest foe. A power and mind of malice guided it. This is Sauron's strategy. Okay. Soon there was a great peril of fire behind the wall, and all who could be spared were busy quelling the flames that sprang up in many places. Then, among the greater castes, there fell another hail, less ruinous, but more horrible. All about the streets and lanes behind the gate, it tumbled down, small round shot that did not burn. But when men ran to learn what it might be, they cried aloud or wept. For the enemy was flinging into the city all the heads of those who had fallen fighting at Osgiliath or on the Ramas, or in the fields. They were grim to look on, for though some were crushed and shapeless, and some had been cruelly hewn, yet many had features that could be told, and it seemed that they had died in pain, and all were branded with the foul token of the lidless eye. But marred and dishonored as they were, it often chanced that thus a man would see again the face of someone he had known, who had walked proudly once in arms, or tilled the fields, or ridden in upon a holiday from the green vales in the hills. As we can see, towards the close of this passage, Tolkien shifts. He detaches from the temptation to obsessively ruminate over the horror, and instead draws inspiration from the old English tradition of lamentation, a tradition of lamentation which consists in honoring the homes, the origins, the stories of the fallen. It is, in a style so characteristic to Tolkien, an understated and swift shift, and it is much shorter a section of the passage than all of the Chronicle of Horror that he has just detailed. But he reframes the entire shape, I propose, of the event by allowing human dignity, the goodness of being, the goodness of home, the goodness of memory, a final word. Even though he does not, for even a sentence, diminish or disregard the full evil of the orcs' terror tactics and their effect upon the people they attack. Tolkien's approach to the evil of terror is not only by his attempts to work through the horrors of perhaps, say, trench warfare, which he had endured, or the experiences of others he had known who had suffered greatly. It is also a response on his part to the literary tradition he deeply loved and that sustained him. The old English poems and fragments, which he studied not only as a scholar, but which he absorbed with great affection, and one could say with reverence. Indeed, his detached narrative turn from focusing on orcish atrocity to the practice of lamentation and honoring the dead is profoundly shaped by his Christian medieval inheritance. In addition to scripture, the liturgy, and the examples of saints, Tolkien's Christian detachment was cultivated in no small part by the literature he read and studied. especially early medieval poetry, which often integrates lyrical or psalm-like lamentation with a profession of hope in the God who is within and beyond the world, who is the sure refuge in a life of change and death. Tolkien was especially drawn to the old English poem, The Wanderer, which some of you might be familiar with, which dates to at least the 10th century, if not earlier. Tolkien preferred the titles The Exile, Alone the Banished Man, or The Exile's Lament to the standard The Wanderer, perceiving in the poem's long catalog of losses an honest appraisal of the contingent human condition and the loneliness often accompanying it. Throughout this long poem, a banished man roams alone, describing his inner state as winter sorrowful. For a period, he lingers over his heart's deep aching, crying out, "Where has the horse gone? Where are my kindred? Where is the giver of treasure? Where are the benches to bear us? Joys of the hall to bring us together. No more the bright goblet, all gone the mailed warrior, lost for good the pride of princes." This old cry from the heart is part of the long-standing ubi sunt, which translates to "where are they" theme in Old English verse. It points to the reality that we must reckon with loss, especially the loss of whatever is nearest and dearest to us: kin, home, family, community. A wanderer could not last long in an old, in the world of Anglo-Saxon poetry. You couldn't live out in the wilderness for long. From an early age, Tolkien encountered so many kinds of loss. It is no wonder then that his works are saturated by the paradoxical presence of loss. His writings at one level are variations of the exiled wanderer's lament. Where are they, those who have gone before us? He often transposed passages from The Wanderer to Lord of the Rings, most evocatively in Aragorn's own lamentation in honor of the fallen Rohirrim. Tolkien's imagination was haunted by all that is winter sorrowful, and yet he does not allow it to consume him, hence the passage that I just shared with you, where he makes that turn. He acknowledges the evil, but then he also turns to focus on the good who have been violated, and gives them back their dignity, as it were, by remembering them in their strength, remembering them in their generosity, in their homes, and in their histories. While Tolkien was very much haunted by all that is winter sorrowful, lamentation did not become bitterness or resentment in him. And if you read his letters, he might not be bitter or resentful. He could be petty. He sometimes would struggle with grudges. You know, I'm not trying to paint him as this perfect person, but it is quite remarkable, given the context of his times, the way that he is able to kind of save the Lord of the Rings from becoming like the Game of Thrones, you know? Anyway, okay. Rather, his lamentation matured into a profound eschatological expectation. I'm going to talk about this in a moment and explain more what I mean. An exercise of the theological virtue of hope, a maturing, growing detachment from one's own desire to control one's own life and circumstances, and instead to seek to receive in hope what might be offered to one, to respond to it, to that offering. Of course, we see this throughout The Lord of the Rings itself and its related legendarium. As Tolkien would share in some of his letters, The Lord of the Rings, especially those passages related to the friendship between Samwise Gamgee, whom he later wished he had named Samwise Goodchild, to give us some more hints perhaps, and Frodo Baggins, their friendship, he said, would often bring tears to his eyes when he was writing, and they made C.S. Lewis cry too. These tears, Tolkien described, were tears of joy, but a joy which was commingled with sorrow, where he thought of joy and sorrow as close cousins, and that you couldn't quite taste full joy unless you had tasted sorrow, and vice versa. These tears were the fruit of Tolkien's efforts to hope in, and therefore discern, signs of providence or of hope in this fading world. The self-sacrificing friendship between Samwise and Frodo, for example, witnessed to and seemed a miracle emerging from a love beyond this world, this Middle Earth. For Tolkien, creative exercise of the imagination, docile to inspiration, including, to his mind, divine inspiration, can offer, as he put it, a sudden glimpse of truth, especially when we are suffering. Elaborating, he says this glimpse of truth gives to your, quote, to your whole nature, chained in material cause and effect, chained in the chain of death, a sudden relief, as if a major limb out of joint has suddenly snapped back. It produces that essential emotion, Christian joy, he says, which produces tears, because it is qualitatively so like sorrow, because it comes from those places where joy and sorrow are at one, reconciled. Sam's and Frodo's friendship, which endured the same losses chronicled in The Wanderer, also, it becomes clear, especially in Tolkien's letters, has its ultimate origins in the divine music of Ilúvatar, which brought Middle-earth into being, as recounted in his cosmic-making myth, the Silmarillion. Despite evil's attempted disruptions of history, or in Tolkien's analogy, evil's attempted disruptions of the music of being, Tolkien was adamant that self-sacrificing love, which is also Christian detachment, not only helps to restore the great harmony of the cosmos, it can become a means of grace, of unlooked-for hope. And I'll return to that point at the end of my talk. Okay, so now I'm shifting towards the final section. In what we've considered so far, I hope it's clear that Tolkien often centers on hope, but not with any kind of naivete. Normally, Tolkien's protagonists must endure various burdens and loads, often ones they feel are beyond their weight, in order to grow, love, and see life more fully. They must typically hope in some form when there seems absolutely no cause for such hope, especially if you only have, you know, what is available to your sense experience and your lived experience. Frodo, for instance, might be one of the most radical examples of this. I don't want to spoil things too much for those of you who might not know too much about what Tolkien has said about Frodo in his letters, but if you're interested in Frodo or the whole dynamic of how the ring actually gets destroyed, go to Tolkien's letters. There's a newly released volume of many letters Tolkien had written, which had never yet been available outside of archives, and he says some very interesting things. Frodo carries a load, as many of us know, beyond his strength. He carries the ring of evil. And Tolkien stressed in his letters to friends and fans that Frodo would have been totally overcome by the ring's temptations at the crack of Mount Doom were it not for Gollum. And as many know, Gollum only makes it to Mount Doom to try and steal the ring from Frodo because Frodo mercifully spared Gollum's life earlier on in the tale, even though Frodo had to risk his own safety in order to do this. The former mercy of Frodo ends up paying back dividends beyond what he could expect and saves him from falling completely into the power of the ring. Gollum, for those of you who might not know, attacks Frodo and takes this ring that they have to destroy in order to put the world back to rights. And Tolkien and Frodo had become so kind of captivated by the power of the ring at the end of the story because the ring is so powerful that if Gollum hadn't attacked him, the ring wouldn't have been destroyed. And for Tolkien, you see this over and over again. Any little good act, whether one is conscious, fully conscious of its implications or not, reverberates throughout history and throughout the lives of different persons. And it is always already more strong than evil, even if evil appears to be more powerful. And this is because Tolkien understood evil to be privative, that which doesn't really have full life or force per se. Rather, it's an absence or a negation of full life. And so that small act of mercy that Frodo gave to his enemy ends up becoming the very thing that saves Frodo in the end. And I think this really helps to capture part of Tolkien's way of working through the grave problem of evil, which we will always have, and which was really becoming, you know, reaching a fever pitch in the 20th century. So that's kind of a cosmic epic example. But let's think of more ordinary, commonplace things, because Tolkien, in some of his other more lighthearted writings that aren't so focused on the epic, or even in some of his letters or the stories he wrote for his children, you see more playful examples of this very principle that I've just been talking about, where Tolkien really was able to detach from the full force of fear or jealousy or pain, and to pull back and to see how little acts of mercy or kindness will always already help to overcome darker things. So to give a more ordinary or prosaic example, in one of Tolkien's novellas called Leif by Nigel, the main character Nigel, and Nigel means, you know, if you're niggled, you're kind of annoyed, right? So this guy who just represents, the struggling artist who represents, who's named Nigel, represented Tolkien, actually. He thought that this was a good example of him. He's quite playful about himself. Nigel, the main character in his story, Leif by Nigel, has to learn to detach from his own schedule and artistic ambitions to help his very annoying neighbor, Parrish, who is in need. But we learn by the end of the story that Nigel's decision to help Parrish because it was the right thing and not because he felt like it ends up contributing to not only the completion of Nigel's art, but also its profound elevation and ultimate transformation in paradise. In addition to his recognition that we must often bear heavy loads, Tolkien was no blind optimist, however. In fact, like Terry Eagleton or Jean-Charles Nault, Tolkien would say human optimism is but an ersatz or substitute or even insufficient hope. Its foundation is ephemera, sand. It will not last. Disappointment, suffering, and death will shift this sand all too easily. And Tolkien had learned this already by the age of 4, when he lost his father and before he could process it. It is not only theological hope, hope beyond the world, as Tolkien would say, that can accompany us on earth and which can be professed in the trenches, even if it requires every effort of the will over and against a storm of conflicting feelings. It is only this theological hope, Tolkien would argue, that can endure. And this is because this theological hope is not grounded in what the world can offer, but in Christ's promise to redeem the world. There's a radically theological shift that occurs in Tolkien's literary criticism, especially in one of his very famous essays of literary criticism called On Fairy Stories, which was first delivered at the University of St. Andrews, and we have a copy of the original essay. It was a lecture for the Andrew Lang series, and Tolkien went and revised the lecture significantly after he delivered it and published it as an essay. It's called On Fairy Stories, and he added a whole other postscript, which was a very explicit theological turn in his writings, where he kind of showed some of his cards, because as John Garth, the remarkable Tolkien scholar, says, very often Tolkien kept his cards to his chest like a good poker player. He sometimes even sent some of his fans on a bit of a goose chase when it came to them asking him what was his inspiration. He was a rather private man. But in this essay, for those of you interested in his literary criticism, he does this theological shift, this turn, where he really mounts this case that every story that seeks after light or beauty or some kind of goodness is implicitly a cry for something beyond the world, beyond what the world can offer. And he argues that that this desire is especially responded to and satisfied in the Christian faith. And this is very similar to an argument from desire that C.S. Lewis makes, for those of you who might be familiar with him. And he outlines this in Surprised by Joy and a few of his other works. For Tolkien, he understood that hope is deeply tied. I jumped ahead of myself. Tolkien's understanding of hope is also deeply tied to his efforts to cultivate Christian detachment, to be watchful, as Newman put it, so as not to trust in what we see alone, not to share in general unbelief, not to be carried away by the world, but to take heed, watch, pray, and look out for his coming, Christ's coming. This mode of hoping especially translates in Tolkien's writings into the recognition on the part of various characters that they may need to risk and even lose their lives to gain the good for their loved ones and homes. This mode of hoping, strengthened by acts of detachment, is also presented more explicitly at the level of form or narrative style in numerous passages across Tolkien's writings, one of which we've already examined. Interestingly, Tolkien often draws upon a sudden, fleeting encounter with a higher order beauty or an unexpected beauty, or the gift of a beautiful memory, in order to emphasize both the fleetingness of this world and the spiritual splendor to which it points. For example, in the chapter The Land of Shadow, in the final book of the trilogy, which precedes the chapter Mount Doom, which is the climax of the whole story, Frodo and Sam have gone beyond what seems to be the end of their strength. Tolkien recounts it as follows. It is worth reading the entire passage because Tolkien knew only too well that you cannot separate the meaning of a text from its form. Form forms our understanding. Form is the very mode of expression, or as Marshall McLuhan liked to say, the medium is the message or the massage. The form of this passage is structured by the kind of detached narrative voice so often present across the trilogy, in which the evil of Sauron is not the last word and sometimes almost seems to become a detail. Okay, so here it goes. I didn't put the entire quotation on the slide because that would bombard you with, I think, a bit too much text. So I just put the most important part, but I'm going to read a little bit more than what's on the screen for context. So this is just before Frodo and Sam reach Mount Doom, and they're kind of at the edge of this barren-looking wasteland that has a bit of forest and cliff where they're hiding to rest before they make their attempt, their ascent up Mount Doom to complete their quest. At last, Frodo could go no further. They had climbed up a narrow shelving ravine. but they still had a long way to go before they could even come in sight of the last craggy ridge. "I must rest now, Sam, and sleep if I can," said Frodo. He looked about, but there seemed nowhere even for an animal to crawl into this dismal country. At length, tired out, they slunk under a curtain of brambles that hung down like a mat over a low rock face. Frodo sighed and was asleep almost before the words were spoken. Sam struggled with his own weariness, and he took Frodo's hand, and there he sat silent till deep night fell. Then at last, to keep himself awake, he crawled from the hiding place and looked out. The land seemed full of creaking and cracking and sly noises, but there was no sound of voice or of foot. Far above the Ethelduath, in the west, the night sky was still dim and pale. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. His song in the tower had been defiance rather than hope, for then he was thinking of himself. This was a song he sang to distract some goblins from attacking him. Now, for a moment, his own fate, and even his master's, ceased to trouble him. He crawled back into the brambles and laid himself by Frodo's side, and putting away all fear, he cast himself into a deep and untroubled sleep. We should notice here that it is the sudden, unannounced entrance of beauty which smites Sam's heart that reveals a light forever beyond the reach of the shadow. And here, as Strack Caldecott observes, beauty functions as the radiance of truth and goodness, shining out as a vision which reveals how everything coheres together, and as importantly, how everything is subordinate to a source of hope which cannot be of the world, even if it is glimpsed within it. We can also note, importantly, that Sam finds some respite from his terrible burden precisely because he detaches from his point of view alone, which has been so fixated on the shadow and staying away from the shadow and fleeing the shadow. But here he's offered a different view. It has nothing to do with the shadow. He's taken up into a higher order vision of the world just for a moment. And this experience of self-forgetfulness makes him mindful that he is part of a larger whole, and that his story is a leaf on a larger tale of trees. But also, he forgets himself for a little while, and this has autobiographical significance for Tolkien as well. He started writing significant portions of his mythology while he was in the trenches, and he talks about the few moments where he could escape to write little snippets of poetry or to wordplay or just think about beautiful things, were some of the only times that he was able to kind of mentally rest and refresh from the burden of the trench life. Okay, now I'm finishing up here. I'm mindful of the time. Beauty across Tolkien's writing is that which repeatedly reminds those who encounter it that there is a wider vision, a higher order to which we are subordinate, but also upon which we can rely. Beauty in his stories functions to help us, as he puts it, regain a higher view. For Tolkien, the purpose of stories, of fantasy in particular, is not, as he says, analytic study, but the recovery, the regaining, he says, of a clear view, the regaining of reality, achieved through a contemplative, watchful attention to the world, to history, to events and persons. This kind of vision of a wider panorama, as it were, a wider horizon, is accomplished in part by distancing or defamiliarizing us through story, to take us away from our ordinary circumstances, thereby reviving our sense of mystery and life, and also to help us see things afresh with a new perspective. Creative fantasy for Tolkien cultivates a spirit of wonder, which announces that all you had or knew was, as Tolkien says, free and wild, no more yours than they were you. Fantasy for Tolkien is best when it helps us to behold as opposed to possess. And that really, if I had to summarize up his aesthetics of attachment, it's that. It's through fantasy, Tolkien says, and this is in his essay on fairy stories, that he first, quote, divined the potency of words and the wonder of things such as stone and wood and iron, tree and grass, house and fire, bread and wine. It is through the Lord of the Rings and his wider reflections on the trilogy, and especially in his letters, that we see the degree to which he offers an aesthetic philosophy, implicitly Catholic, in which a self-forgetting wonder at the world in its beauty, terror, and majesty enables the very act of story-making to serve as a correlative or an aid to a hope within but beyond the world. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.